obviously we have a joint meeting here. I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Representative Shields.
And I'd like to open up an informational meeting of the Subcommittee of Public Safety, Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative. And before we begin and start the information from those testifying, I'm going to turn over to the co-chair, Representative Nolan, who has a few words of wisdom.
Thank you, and welcome. Senator Schrader and I have attended one of the subcommittee meetings and received this presentation just a little while ago. I want to just thank the presenters as well as the committee members. This is very important and, in fact, as you'll hear, quite sobering information that can provide a very important background for everybody as they go through their Ways and Means Subcommittee deliberations. Really important information about debt management, about pending lawsuits, and about issues that some of our county partners are facing that affect our budget deliberations as well. So thank you for being here. It's good stuff, and I don't want to take any more of their time.
Thank you, Representative Nolan. And so as we do in the legislature, we have all this incredibly important information, but we have limited time, so I'm going to ask the members of the committee, to the extent possible, to not ask a lot of questions, I guess is what I want to say. So the goal is to be adjourned by 4:30 in the afternoon. I think that is quite an ambitious goal, but to the extent we can try to do that, that would be phenomenal. And prior to the introduction of the public testimony, I have been given a piece of paper which says no, I wasn't even talking about that piece of paper.
Oh.
I'm talking about another piece of paper that you have to pay attention to, please. This is instructions for all of us regarding the paper that we have sitting in front of us. So the copies of the adopted rules that are at the dais, those should be placed in the orientation binders under tab 2.
Sure, you might.
No, I didn't. Okay. Pardon me?
I was not informed to bring my notebook.
Oh, okay. And the copies of the 0709 benchmarks from Friday's presentation should be placed under tab 7. Can you see how well organized we are in this session? And the handouts for the rest of the week's presentations will be provided to all members, one per member. So if you attend more than one meeting, please only take one copy. So with that, I would like to turn it over to good folks to provide information on state bonding and debt issuance. And I'll hand it over to Kay Richardson, Laura Lockwood McCall, and Jack Kenny.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, I'm Chief of Staff for State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and we're here today to give you the background on the state bonding in Oregon. We'll let other people talk about big lawsuits. And I don't know what tab you'll will be under, but I think you should have a presentation in front of you that Laura will be giving about state bonding. And just very briefly, the State Treasurer issues all state bonds for the state, and this is a very important thing for you to be paying attention to, because this really goes into a lot of allocation decisions for you. Bonding can be a wonderful tool. It really can help us finance a lot of those big capital needs and infrastructure needs, but it comes at a cost, and there are funds that you tie up there which can be very well spent, but it means they're not available elsewhere. So those are big policy decisions for you, and we're here to provide you the background on the different kinds of bonds, different type of decisions that you'll be making and looking at this session. Jack Kenny from the Department of Administrative Services Capital Finance section will be also talking about those specifically to some of the bills you'll be looking at this session. So I do want to just preface the statements too with that if you do have questions, I know you won't be asking them, but if you want to ask some of them later, you're always welcome to stop by our office in room 159, and we're happy to answer any specific questions you have. So with that, Laura Lockwood McCall, our Debt Management Director for the State Treasurer's Office.
Thank you, Kate. For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management in the Office of the State Treasurer.
I'm going to quickly take you through sort of our bonding 101 and then turn it over to Jack, as Kate mentioned, to talk about specific things in the bond bill and some of the processes you'll be going through in your deliberations. First, a few definitions. I'll give you a brief snapshot of the U.S. debt market and how Oregon's bonds fit into that larger bond market. Some issues surrounding credit ratings. I'll talk about the bonding process, and Jack will get into more depth about sort of decision points in that process. What is our long-term debt trends? What's been going on in terms of our overall debt? I'll talk about the debt capacity recommendations that the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission will be looking at in the coming weeks. And a quick overview of how we compare to other states in terms of some key debt ratios. First, what's a bond? It's basically just the process of borrowing money. I like to use the analogy that a bond issue is really no different than a homeowner who's deciding to take out a mortgage for their home or a car loan for their car. You usually can't borrow all that, pay for something all up front, and so you need to borrow money, and so you have investors who are willing to loan you money at a given interest rate. It's our promise to repay. There are scheduled principal and interest payments that you'll see debt service of already existing debt in a variety of the state agency budgets. Where do we fit in? Well, the U.S. bond market as of 2005 represents about $24.7 trillion, of which municipal bonds, which is the state of Oregon, local school districts, water, sewer, you name it, throughout the country, represents about 9% or $2.2 trillion. It's a vast market, and we're just one of many, many players in it. Why do we issue bonds? It's probably the major source of funding of our long-term infrastructure and capital needs, the things that we need to acquire today that we are willing to pay for over time. A public policy argument could be made that since these are long-term life for these assets, that if you issue debt over a fairly long period, 20 to 30 years, that the users of these different assets are paying their fair share over the years, whether it's taxes or revenues. The interest on municipal bonds sold by the state as well as local governments in Oregon are exempt. The interest on it for investors is exempt from both state and federal taxes, and therefore they're willing to offer us a much lower interest rate because on an after-tax basis it's an attractive investment, which has big ramifications for us. Currently, if we were selling 25-year bonds, let's say for a lottery, which we'll be doing in the next few days, we're probably looking at less than a 5% interest rate for 20-year debt, which is very good compared to what you could get as a mortgage market, which is considered the taxable side of the fence. Jack's going to talk more about the types of bonds, but just briefly, some of the largest things we've been financing bonds for lately are correctional facilities, transportation improvements, higher education, and community colleges. We do have a number of other bond programs where the general fund is not as directly involved or taxes are directly involved to finance things like economic and rural development, single and multifamily housing programs, veterans home loans, energy projects, drinking water pollution control. And these benefit local governance throughout the state. Bond credit ratings. Just as using the analogy of the mortgage, when you try and get a mortgage, you usually have credit scores where people are taking, in essence, they're determining your degree of risk in terms of your repayment. Similarly, the state has to meet with three rating agencies. We go through quite a detailed analysis of the state's finances and other information, and they then in turn look at all sorts of other issuers, the state credits, local credits, and determine our credit rating. Now, the very highest credit rating is a AAA, but credit ratings on the AA, A, and B, BBB categories are also considered investment grade. These are sort of fine variations on a theme. There's very, very low default rate with municipal bonds, perhaps less than 1% overall. Nevertheless, they're trying to send signals to investors as to just so that these slight differences, and so a single A credit may pay a slightly higher interest rate than a double A credit, and then of course triple A. Below BBB- is where you get off, where it's no longer investment grade. So obviously, with these little differentiations, having a higher credit rating will affect our interest rates and the bonds we borrow and the overall cost of financing for various programs that the state manages. What are they looking at? Well, for general obligation bonds, I've listed the four categories above. Financial performance of jurisdiction, our governance framework, and our management practices are probably overweighted in terms of the overall. Those are really quite key to the credit rating. But also they look at our debt burden in terms of outstanding indebtedness versus these ratios we're going to look at, as well as our economic base, because they're concerned about not just today, but over the life of those bonds, will the economy generate the types of taxes and activity that will make sure that we'll be always able to pay all the debt that we issue. On revenue bonds, we're also looking at all of those factors, as well as the specific strength of the revenue streams. For example, highway user taxes, which support various ODOT initiatives. They're looking at those streams and looking at long-term trends. Recently, ODOT's bonds were upgraded to AAA by Standard & Poor's, which is a pretty strong statement. They looked at our legal and financial agreements and the rate covenants, and they felt those were a strong credit. This next chart shows you, just as a snapshot, where are we today for our general obligation bonds, which is the best way we can describe it is what is our general fund, which is really ultimately what they're looking at. As you'll see in the box on the left, there's a lot of states that have a higher credit rating currently compared to the state of Oregon. We're currently rated AA-, with a few states below us who have some serious budget problems. And you can see in the case of Wisconsin, they're AA- like we are, but they're on positive credit watch, which is an indication that probably the next rating change will be an upward rather than a downward correction. This is a chart since 1990 of how the three different rating agencies have viewed the state of Oregon's credit. Probably the highest point was when we were AA across the board in 1996. And there's differences in theory and philosophy. There's slight differences and nuances between the three agencies, but they all agreed in 2003 that given the just the tremendous problems the state was going through in terms of the revenue problems in 2003, we were downgraded one notch by all three agencies. Actually, Fitch went two notches, which may have been an overreaction, and then chose to bring us back up to AA- in 2005. Feedback from the rating agencies as far as what we do right, what we do wrong. Just real quickly, I'll go through those. Our biggest strength is we have really strong financial controls, and that includes budget controls, accounting controls, good investment controls, good debt management controls, and we get very high marks from all three agencies for that. They like our conservative consensus-based revenue forecasting process, and many states have multiple revenue forecasts competing between the legislative branch, the executive branch, and it's considered a credit positive that we have a relatively non-political consensus-based process with outside advisors giving us assistance. We have a constitutional balanced budget requirement, which is also very positive. And the rating agencies take quite seriously your responsibilities and your willingness to meet budget adjustments. When the legislature came into session, 2001-2003 session, five separate times to deal with revenue forecast modifications, legislature took the cuts or did the one-time improvements to revenues that were needed. The rating agencies acknowledge, as difficult as that may have been, that that was a very strong credit factor in our ratings. We have sound debt management and capital planning policies. We do have a growing economic base and greater diversification of that base, and that's acknowledged in the reports. Growing educational stability fund for all practical purposes is our budget reserves. While those were not terribly high the last fiscal round, they're estimated to grow to 2, 3, 4% perhaps even of general fund revenues by the end of this upcoming biennium, and that's an important consideration for them. And finally, unlike some states, we've taken upon ourselves to do comprehensive pension reform, another very difficult task, but many states are facing unfunded retiree health care liabilities as well as pension liabilities in the multi-billions of dollars. And while we do have some retiree health care liabilities, they are pale in comparison. And I think that in the coming years, we'll push very hard with the rating agencies on that front, and we'll continue to push, and you'll be reading quite a bit, I'm sure, about other states and some of their problems. Now for weaknesses, our number one ongoing thing we see in our rating agency reports is that we have low budget reserves. And compared with 50 other states, there's National Association of State Budget Officers reports on rainy day funds or ending balances. Oregon generally comes up as one of the lower throughout the country. Coupled with that, we're criticized for the uncertainty that's associated with the voter initiative activity. We can talk about how we manage well with our strong financial controls, but nevertheless, there's always sort of this unknown outlier that could come and affect our budget. And so generally, of course, investors like stability, and this introduces an element of potential instability. The 2% kicker law, because it makes it difficult for us to build up that budgetary cushion, as often mentioned in reports. Also, our reliance on a cyclical income tax for the bulk of our revenues, to the degree that we're more diversified in our different streams of revenue, they see that as a credit positive because it would provide a bit more stability. We do have moderate debt, and it is going to most likely increase as we continue to issue the ODOT bonds. So that, you'll see in upcoming charts, we were relatively below median, and now we're at the median to slightly above the median for 50 states. And we did use one time deficit financing to meet some of the revenue shortfall problems of 2001-2003 budget cycle. As a result, that's a little black mark against us, but as time fades and we don't choose that route again, then that will go off the table as a weakness. Jack will go into more depth about the budget, the bond issuance and approval process, but just briefly, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission will be publishing a report in the next several weeks that will provide forecasts of overall prudent general fund and lottery revenue debt capacity. And we look at existing debt service on existing bonds. We take the most recent forecast, which in this case will be the December 06 revenue forecast, and we basically forecast forward how much capacity we would have to issue additional bonds over the next three budget cycles. And I think I'll let Jack cover the rest of this, other than, as Kate to allude to, that we're the Central Debt Management Service Oversight Agency, and we take it very seriously. We make sure that every bond issue, the cash flows work, that the state is protected and being looked at carefully. Four major types of debt. First, we have general obligation bonds. These all require a carve-out in the Constitution because the Constitution basically says the state legislature cannot issue more than $50,000 with that, except for these carve-outs. And Jack will talk about what those carve-outs are for specific bond programs. We do get to pledge our full faith and credit for those transactions, and that is our general obligation credit. It used to be our highest credit rating, but actually the rating agencies have upgraded our ODOT bonds and our lottery revenue bonds, so now we have actually a higher credit rating on those than we do on our general obligation bonds, at least in a few cases. General obligation bonds can be general fund supported or can be self-supporting, depending on which type they are. And generally speaking, the debt limits are much, much higher constitutionally than what would be really prudent or practical, which is why we have the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission to set more realistic targets for ourselves. The revenue bonds are created by the legislature through statute. They're not secured by this unconditional pledge to pay, but rather are fully self-supporting through these program revenues, which, both in the case of, particularly in the case of lottery, have been growing very strongly, which is partially why we have this unusual situation with such a high credit rating. Appropriation credit bonds, Jack will talk about great length, but briefly, they're both the deficit bonds that were sold in 03, as well as certificates of participation, and it's a pledge to annually appropriate what we need to make the debt service payments. They're generally paid for through the general fund, so we pay a lot of attention to those in the debt capacity report, and they're not secured by the full faith and credit of the state. We also have conduit or pass-through revenue bonds, which really have no state support other than we're the issuer, they're self-supporting, they stand alone, and really, in essence, we're supporting certain key public policies by allowing certain activities to occur, financed, that get the tax exemption to both state and federal. I'm going to skip this just in the interest of time, but this is just a sort of summary of some key provisions of the debt limits and current outstanding indebtedness. Now, here's some overall trends. Over the last 20 years, if we were looking 20 years ago, almost all the state's debts was veterans mortgage loans, self-supporting. There was almost nothing that the general fund was involved in. However, you can see that since the 90s, in particular, the late 90s, we started issuing a lot more in the way of both COPs as well as revenue bonds. The revenue bonds are primarily for housing programs, both single-family and multifamily housing, self-supporting. COPs, primarily growing amount for correctional facilities. And then in 2003, you see the big pop where we did both the appropriation deficit bonds, but we also sold $2 billion in general obligation debt to finance unfunded pension liabilities at a lower interest cost than we would have otherwise had to pay to PERS. So sometimes you issue debt to actually reduce your costs, even though you still, you know, have a, you do increase our overall debt. And lastly, this trend's probably going to continue upward as we continue to issue bonds for the OTIF-3 program. We have, still have about $1.4 billion in authorization. I anticipate that it will be issued in phased approach over the next couple of biennials. The next couple of slides just go through the details. You can look at your leisure of what I just brought forth. And I want to stop briefly on this page because I think you can see the COPs, how they really started growing. And Jack will talk about the reasons why. And then the appropriation deficit bonds, which is the red. That debt will be paid off in full in 2014. Now, as a debt capacity committee meets, they'll be looking at very carefully the general fund supported debt. And a lot of what Jack has talked to you about today will focus on that. The Debt Capacity Policy Commission's target goal is to keep debt service as a percentage of general fund revenues at or below 5%. As of the end of the fiscal year, we were at 3.7%. Now, forecasting forward, again, taking into account existing debt service and current forecast of general fund revenues, we would have capacity, and this is maximum, of approximately $847 million in new bonding and general fund-supported debt categories, and stay within the 5% criteria. It's not necessarily what we should issue. This is just a forecast of what the, really the maximum is to stay within a prudent limit. Similarly, we've done forecasts for lottery bonds. There's a covenant requiring four times the lottery revenue for every dollar of debt service. And the state also, by the way, has a moral obligation pledge to replenish a debt service reserve if, for whatever reason, lottery revenues fall down and we need to actually tap into that reserve fund. As of the end of the fiscal year, our coverage was 7.4 times. Again, to explain why at least one or two rating agencies recently upgraded that. Revenues are strong, coverage is high. And they, I must also point out that they changed their criteria for how they look at revenue bonds. Despite the recession of the mid-early 2000s, lottery revenues kept growing. So it proved to be somewhat insensitive to economic conditions. Again, this is not what the commission will recommend, but we forecast maximum capacity. And as a result, because of the revenue forecast being so robust over the last year for lottery, the maximum business forecast would be at $1 billion. We're not going to recommend that. We're going to suggest that we phase over 6 years. I think it's $1.4 billion and maybe no more than 450 or 470 in any one biennium. Because if the lottery revenues fall, the forecast will drop just as precipitously as it's gone up. Now, different states have different ways of slicing and dicing their bonding. Some states keep their transportation in the general fund. Other states don't have lottery. So when the rating agencies want to compare 50 states, they have to come up with this different thing called just net tax-supported debt. It's all of your debt, anything with taxes at all. And so that way they can say, well, what's the net tax-supported debt of Oregon versus Florida versus Georgia? So that's what they look at. So I'm going to show you some charts on that in a moment. But briefly, whoops, pardon me.
We're not that short on time.
I've been accused of worse, so excuse me. My geodator. I'm going to have to... What I wanted to show you, and I apologize, was just what is in the category of general fund supported debt. I've got to get out here because I want to get you right to that page. There we go. So these are all the bonds that are part of general, what we call general fund supported debt. And currently, as of the end of fiscal year, we have $2.6 billion currently outstanding of general fund supported debt. And I think the key point is only a portion of the pension obligation bonds are considered general fund supported because SC pays the debt service. The balance of our pension obligation bonds are paid by other agencies around the state that are not part of the general fund. But when they look at net tax supported debt, they say 100% of pension obligation bonds are part of that net tax supported number, as well as all the highway user tax bonds we have, and as well as the lottery revenue bonds. So when you look at it from that perspective, we're at $5.4 billion. So that's the basis of the two charts I want to show you next, which is what are the recent trends and how do we compare to other states. So again, if you look across this chart, the blue squares show you what the medians have been for 50 states. And the lighter blue shows you where we were for many, many years. We were well below the medians. In the last few years, not just because we sold pension obligation bonds, which is the white part, but just the ODOT debt, the lottery revenue bonds, and other general fund-supported programs, we're now at or slightly exceeding the medians. So I think that's important. We look at per capita, and we also look at, I think, probably a little closer to what we need to look at is debt as a percentage of personal income. Again, we're slightly above the medians now. Not all states chose to issue pension obligation bonds. So you have to look at it both with and without to be able to kind of figure out how we're really doing. With that, I just want to close by saying that, again, I think the state is managing its debt prudently. We need to be careful as to how we allocate future debt capacity to ensure it's really being used for the highest priorities. And then finally, to whatever extent that you all see towards better budget reserves for the state, I can assure you that will lead to higher credit ratings and lower borrowing costs. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Lockwood McCall. And was it the third time that you've done this presentation today?
I think I got it right finally.
No, I applaud your stamina, and thank you very much. And if the committee would indulge me, if we can get through the next two presentations on this larger subject and then ask questions, that would be phenomenal. So, Mr. Kinney?
Thank you, Chair. You should have a handout with my name on it. I'm Jack Kenny, the finance manager for the Budget Management Division. And it's nice to follow Laura. She does such a good job in covering those major issues. So I'm going to focus on legislation that you will see as members of the Ways and Means Committee and on three specific bond programs that you have the most discretion. So if you use the money in one area or don't use it in one area, you might be able to use it in another. Before I do that, I do have the first page of my handout talks about controls on the bond issuance process, and some of those you exercise, others are exercised by others. The first one is there's a limit on outstanding debt. So the amount of debt we can have outstanding at any one point in time is controlled either through the Constitution or through statutes. And Laura's already talked about that a little bit. There's also a biennial limit on the amount of bonds that can be issued. So the amount of bonds that you can issue or that the state can issue in any biennium is controlled by you through the bond bill. And I'll spend a little more time on that. And then the state treasurer also reviews and approves individual bond sales. So if something had been approved by the legislature during session and then circumstances changed afterwards, the state treasurer has the ability to put the brakes on a bond sale if that's the appropriate thing to do. Market forces are the next control. In the bond bill, there'll be large numbers, ceilings, if you will, approved for certain programs. But if the market is not supportive of issuing at those levels, then we won't. And sometimes there'll be amounts that'll be approved in different programs, and depending where the market is, you'll see more activity in one program than another. For example, industrial development revenue bonds versus housing bonds. Sometimes there's more activity in one area or the other. The federal tax code is another restriction or control on bond issuance process. There's only certain things you can do with tax-exempt bonds. Typically, it's capital construction. Laura mentioned one of the exceptions with the appropriate appropriation bonds that were issued in 2002. But generally speaking, it's capital construction or large equipment purchases. That's their allowable uses of tax-exempt bonds. And they also, the tax code also limits what you can do with the proceeds when you sell bonds. You don't typically spend it all right away. You have some money to invest. There's limits on what you can do with that. The length of the bonds usually matches the can be longer usually by much than the length of the useful life of the investment. So those protections. And then the Securities and Exchange Commission has regulations on information that must be issued relative to bond programs. So with that, I'll move to my next slide, which really gets to the meat of what Ways and Means is going to look at. So many of you have been here before, so I'll be brief, but I'll try to. But this is really, I think, the meat of what your decision-making process is and where the policy choices that you'll make come into play. Briefly, as I said, most bonds are done for capital projects. So there's an entity called the Capital Planning Advisory Board, made up of private and public sector experts in real estate and capital markets. They will review the agency's budget. So approximately 6 months prior to an agency submitting its budget for the governor's review, they appear before the Capital Planning Advisory Board. And those experts will look at how they have developed their capital plans. Well, you know, issues such as lease versus buy. Do they have build appropriate budgets so that they can maintain? There won't be a lot of deferred maintenance and things like that. How much their space needs are. So those experts kind of give the government entities a helping hand there. Then the agency puts together its budget request. In their budget request, what you will be seeing in various appropriation bills will include things like capital improvements, equipment, grant and loan funds that they need, and unique agency needs such as highway funds for ODOT. Obviously, every agency has a strong commitment to their constituency, and they are going to build a budget to meet the needs of their constituents. That's what you would expect. But obviously, as you might also expect, there's a lot more needs out there than there is debt capacity. So at the same time that agencies are developing their budget on a parallel track, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, as Laura's already talked about, is developing its numbers on how much debt capacity is out there. The governor, in his process, takes both of those issues into account and looks at how much capacity we have versus how much the demands are, makes his priorities, and establishes in the governor's budget what projects are going to be included. And obviously you'll have an opportunity to look at that and give your own opinion on that. The form that this all comes out is a number of bills that will come before the Ways and Means Committee, and that's the next series of boxes. Agency appropriation bills. They will have debt service, as I said, equipment, capital construction, grant loans. So you'll see lots of elements that will be bonded in limitations in agency appropriation bills. So you get a chance to look at it there. The bond bill that we've talked about, and that's what a lot of my next few slides are going to be dealing with, is House Bill 5005 in the 2007 session. So you will see the bond bill before Ways and Means, and it will have the limits on by program on the amount of bonds that can be issued for that program. The capital construction bill, I'll talk about this briefly. House Bill 5006 in the session will come before Ways and Means. The capital construction bill has those items over $500,000 that the governor has approved through agency budgets. Capital construction appropriations are for 6 years, just to remind you of that. So whereas the bond bill is for a two-year period, if you approve a capital construction item in House Bill 5006, that appropriation will be good for 6 years. Now, in some cases, the projects are so well developed that you'll have the entire six-year budget in the capital construction bill. They may know all the costs that it's going to take, and maybe it'll take 3 years or 4 years to build the building. Once that's approved in House Bill 5006, they will have 6 years to spend those funds. In other cases, even though it'll be a long-term project, it'll be phased in the capital construction budget. An example of that would be the state hospital, or the replacement for the state hospital. As you know, in the governor's budget, there's a proposal to replace the aging state hospital. And that project has not been fully developed yet. There's a lot of policy decisions that you all, the legislature, will have to make with the governor in terms of how many buildings, where they're going to be located, and things like that. But Phase one, which is largely land acquisition and a few other pre-construction items, phase one is in the capital construction budget and in the tune of about $85 million. So you'll be looking at that. You'll be looking at large construction project items in House Bill 5006. Similarly, in Senate Bill 5516, higher ed and the community colleges have their own capital construction budget separate from the rest of the state government. So you'll be looking at large construction projects in Senate Bill 5516. Again, those have a six-year life. Once they're approved, you have 6 years to spend those funds. And there's the lottery bond authorization bills. The largest one will be House Bill 5036. So most of the items that will be funded through lottery bonds, the authorization for those projects will be included in House Bill 5036. There'll be others. There'll be a separate bill for the ODOT Connect Oregon 2, which is non-transportation infrastructure, rail spurs, barge facility improvements, airport, things like that. And then I've got another box there for other proposed bills, because there's many times constituents will bring forward projects or programs that they want funded with lottery bonds that weren't in the governor's recommended budget. An example of that in the current biennium was the North Bend Regional Airport. That was brought forward with lottery-backed bonds in the proposal, and that was approved by the legislature. So all those items are what you will look at in Ways and Means, and the end of it all will be what our budget will be when you make your decisions. My next slide is bond issuance authority. Laura's talked about this, and I'll try to move it along, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, obviously there's a constitutional prohibition on debt, on the legislature creating debt, anything in the excess of $50,000. And as you know from Laura's previous presentation, we're well over $50,000 in outstanding debt. That's because there's a lot of notwithstanding clauses in the Constitution. The ones that I have listed on this page, 11A, 11F, 11G, 11H, 11I, 11J, the reason that I have those listed and not the rest of the alphabet there is because those are the items that are in the bond bill, House Bill 5005. So you will see in the governor's budget, in House Bill 5005, amounts for new bonds in these particular categories. Some of the major ones, or one of the major ones that isn't listed here, is 11O. That's pension bonds, $2 billion. Other ones go back historically. I think 11, one of the other ones was for veterans bonuses and things like that. Anyway.
Rural
electrification. Thank you, Senator Devlin. All right. Again, in the interest of time, I think Laura's already talked about this, but again, there will be line items in the bond bill for each of these items, direct revenue bond programs. I'm not going to spend as much time on that because the revenues from these programs are usually dedicated only to those programs. So there's you will see dollar amounts in there. The various agencies will be able to talk about the purposes of those revenue bonds. Laura's already talked about highway gasoline tax for the highway funds, things like that. Pass-through revenue bonds, I think Laura's done a good job on that. That's where the state puts its credit, allows an entity, a lot of times it's an industry that's wanting to expand a plant or build a new plant. The state will allow them to put their name on that, on the bond, to get the tax-exempt status to create jobs. Same thing for affordable housing in some cases. Sometimes universities, private universities and things. Certificates of participation, I'm going to spend a little more time on that because, again, that's one of those areas where you have more discretion and your decisions will impact major, major projects for the state of Oregon. Those are issued through my agency, Department of Administrative Services. And then the private activity bond issuance authority is the last thing that's in the bond bill. The federal government allows only a certain amount of tax-exempt bonding authority for these public-private partnerships or things that have a private component, and that could be the housing single-family mortgage program. Individuals own those homes, I think one there was in Scappoose where they did an alternative fuels plant. So again, it's the industry that's getting a benefit there, so there's only so much of that tax-exempt status that the federal government allows any state to have, and that amount is allocated by agency in the bond bill, including for local governments. All right, certificates of participation. These are technically, and thanks for staying with me so late in the afternoon on this fascinating topic. Certificates of participation are technically not debt. They were initially authorized in 89. Laura's talked about this. The constitutionalities of these were upheld in Cain versus Goldschmidt in 89. This basically allows the state to borrow outside of those notwithstanding constitutional issues. And the primary use for this has been prison construction. And so the use, as you saw on Laura's charts, increased significantly after 1994 when Measure 11 was passed. COPs by statute are used to finance real and personal property and certain infrastructure. It is one form of an appropriation credit. The other example Laura talked about was when we were in deficit position and borrowed money in 2002 to fund that deficit. The difference between that and COPs is that a COP is also lease debt. So what that means is when we sell bonds, the bondholders are protected because they're basically, if you will, they have collateral, so to speak. It's probably not the technical term, but they, in a sense, own the prison and are leasing it to us, the bondholders are. And typically that's what's done when COPs are sold, is a major asset, such as a prison, is put down as collateral. So even though the COP is subject to appropriation, and those are the when you get an appropriation bill and you see debt service, that's where you are making the decision to appropriate the funds to repay the COPs. They don't, you know, there's no full faith and credit pledge. But if you don't approve those debt service amounts in those budgets, then essentially the bondholders have the right to come in and, if you will, take the prison back. But we can't use it anymore. Kick us out. So that's their protection as bondholders. The next slide is the pie chart showing COP issuance. As you see there, corrections is 64% of it. DAS is 21%. That's for building, state buildings, fleets, computer systems, and the like. The DPSST is 7%, and on and on. Again, I'd be happy, as the Treasurer's Office mentioned, I'm also very happy to answer any questions. Let me get to that. Lottery bonds. Laura talked about those. The revenues have been extremely robust in recent years, and that's allowed us to increase credit ratings. They are special obligations of the state. They are not backed by the full faith and credit. It's subject to lottery revenues to pay back those bonds. But a couple things of interest, I guess, on lottery bonds is, one, they have a priority. So as Laura mentioned, once lottery bonds are issued, they basically get first dibs on the lottery revenue once you pay for prizes and lottery administration. So before you could do anything else with lottery funds in the future, you've got to make sure that you set aside money for the bondholders. And that's in the Constitution, Article 15, Section 4. So lottery bonds do have that protection of first dibs, if you will, on the revenue. They are also backed by the state's moral obligation pledge, which means if revenues were insufficient to pay bondholders, that as noted here, the Legislative Assembly acknowledges its current intent to provide appropriated funds to pay that debt service, although it's not compelled to do so. And then Laura, I think, touched on it briefly. The state has covenant bondholders a 4x coverage test. That means that if we have a dollar in debt service for bonds, lottery bonds outstanding, we have to have, in the prior year, $4 in revenue. Essentially what that means. Next slide shows the outstanding lottery bond principal of December 31st, 41% for economic development, that's the primary use, education 35%, transportation 12%, and that'll be going up with the Connect Oregon bonds that we're going to sell here in the next couple of weeks. And then finally, 11G bonds. These, again, these are the big three, if you will, that do have more discretion than the other bond programs, although you obviously have discretion in all the programs. These are backed by general fund. They are basically for higher ed and community college construction projects, including repair and improvements. If a building on the higher ed campus is able to be self-sustaining, typically a parking structure or a dorm where fees or would pay for it, then it should be funded on the 11F program. This is for buildings that higher ed buildings that aren't self-sustaining or community college. There is a general fund match requirement for 11F. The legislature has not always used, I guess, what you'd call a straight or a standard general fund to provide that match. Sometimes it's been matched with lottery bonds. In the case of the community colleges, the general fund match is actually raised by the local community college district. They'll do a bond sale or raise or provide taxes or whatever. So the community colleges provide their own match. Currently, $189.4 million outstanding in 11G bonds. On the chart on the next page shows debt service for 11G bonds. Basically, it's around $30 million for the next several biennia. Last but not least, issues on the horizon. Just to give you a sense of what you will be dealing with and what the governor had to deal with in allocating limited debt capacity to a variety of projects. I'll go through these, but I think a lot of them you're familiar with and maybe some less so. Replacing the state hospital, the estimates of that could be $300 to $400 million. Again, $85 million in the current budget. The next major prison, I think there's some planning funds for the next major prison in this 2007-09 budget, but most of the construction costs estimated at around $300 million will be in 2009-13. The wireless interoperability network, cost estimates can be as high as $665 million for the wireless interoperability network. Again, that'll be done in three phases, I believe. At least that's the plan currently. I'm sure most of you that have been on Ways and Means before have heard higher ed talk about the deferred maintenance needs at their organization, at their institutions. I know that corrections as well has some significant deferred maintenance needs. So those can be funded through bond programs. The higher ed and community college projects that aren't deferred maintenance, I guess just the expansion of our institution of higher education and facilities and their needs. OTEA, Laura talked about that, highways and bridges, continuing. I think we spent about, or we plan to spend $600 million in the current biennium there in bonds. Probably be a similar amount in 2007-09. I think there's $800 million in the budget. Connect Oregon, again, I think I talked about that, non-highway infrastructure. There's $100 million in lottery bonds in the governor's budget for 2007-09 for things like rail spurs and barge improvements and the like. State building needs, including the capital remodel, local government infrastructure funded typically through OECDD and its bond bank, computer system needs, a large project in the current biennium, 2007-09, is the judicial information network upgrade or replacement. And obviously seismic needs throughout the state. There's studies that are being conducted now through I think OEM or Dogami to determine what the seismic needs of the state are, and they will be significant. So that concludes my presentation. Again, I'd be happy to answer questions, or I can give you my number or my card if you'd like to, and you can contact me separately. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenny. That's the shot of the horizon was quite sobering, and I appreciate that. And Kate, I thought I heard an additional surname. I have. Still, it just says Kate Richardson.
I used two, but one is fine. So it's Cooper Richardson.
So does that... Oh, Cooper. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I like to try to be correct, so...
It's not hyphenated if you want to know that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
fine.
Kate Richardson, you have before Kate Cooper Richardson.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm just here to respond to any questions that you might have specifically for the state treasurer, but in the interest of time, I think that I'll invite you to direct them to us personally.
Thank you very much. So, questions? Senator Burdick?
Thank you. You mentioned that one of the liabilities that we have in terms of our credit rating, two of our liabilities are the kicker and the lack of a rainy day fund. My question is, how much of a rainy day fund would we have in percentage terms of our general fund to make an impression on the rating agencies? And the second part of the question is, if we're able to get rid of the corporate kicker, would that improve their opinion of our stability?
Representative Galizo and Senator Burdock. First of all, the rating agencies do acknowledge that the Education Stability Fund, which is funded through a portion of lottery revenues, is seen as a budget reserve. It just fills somewhat slowly. And so I believe at the end of this fiscal year, we're forecasting the 230.
452.
No, but that's next fiscal. Okay. The 230. So that would represent about a general fund budget of $6 billion, give or take 2 or 3%. I think that, am I right?
It's projected to be 3% at the end of the 0709.
Okay, so by 0709 it will be 3%. So it's small, but it's there. They won't give you a hard rule of thumb what you must have, combining ending balance, rainy day fund, educational stability fund. People have different names, but all your different buckets of reserves in terms of the downturn revenues. At a minimum, they'd like to see 5%. That's probably a good rule of thumb. If you're a state that's dependent on a really cyclical income stream, tax stream, you may want to go a little higher than that because of the volatility of that revenue stream. I think that we are going to press on the fact that the Educational Stability Fund is growing to the extent that any kind of kickers or anything, whatever policy technique that the legislature decides to do to build reserves, they will appreciate. They won't want to weigh in as to whether corporate kickers are good or bad or personal income taxes. They're looking for an overall financial structure that builds more stability.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think this is for Jack. The, from what I can see, we have $189.4 million outstanding in the higher ed bonds, and about, if it's 64% of the COPs go to corrections, about $650 million outstanding in for prisons. Do you have any sense, I'm not sure if you're the right person to answer this or not, of how much we end up paying in the general fund for debt service for prisons then?
For prisons, specifically, I can get back to you on that, Representative Shields. The total lottery and general fund debt service in the governor's 2007-09 budget is about $546 million. So that's general fund and lottery.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that was actually my question because I just wanted to see the people to get the comparison between the two, not to react just to the amount that we have in obligations for higher ed and community colleges.
And for those who are listening with rapt attention on the internet, that was Senator Devlin. All right, Representative Nathan's work.
Thank you. I have two questions, and it's fine. Honoring your desire that we attempt to adjourn by 4:30, it's okay if you want to send these responses to my office. The first question, it relates to debt service. That is, so for Laura, if we increase our debt, for example, the items that are in the governor's recommended budget or other items, if we increase our debt, yet it is still at or below the 5% debt service target and these other targets that you have listed, would that, having increased our debt, negatively impact the possibility of improving our bond rating? Or as long as we stay within the targets, do we still have a good chance at improving the rating?
I could answer that if it's very short. Otherwise, I don't believe that if we stay within these prudent debt limits, that would have an impact, positive or negative, on our credit rating. The fact that we have a policy and practice and procedure just to create a debt capacity model and live within that, they already give us a positive. So it's not like going closer to it's better or worse.
That was helpful. Thank you. And the other one is for Jack. On the last page, not numbered, but I believe it's the last page, you've labeled it Issues on the Horizon. Is every one of these already included in the governor's recommendation? No. Or are some included and some not? And you can just mark it up and send it to me later if you'd like.
I'd be happy to do that. But
thank you.
Just for the rest of the committee, no, not all these items are in the governor's budget. But
it would be nice to just have it marked up. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question has to do with the general fund debt capacity that you've estimated for the 07-09 biennium of $847 million. Is that an arithmetic calculation, or is that risk-adjusted based on the volatility of our revenue system?
May I answer?
Of course, please.
Senator Morse. We do a math calculation based on actual debt service, and interest rates, 5-year sort of average of where interest rates have been and what you can leverage. And then we look at the revenue forecast. So we use the December 06 revenue forecast. For lottery bonds, we've begun to do, if revenues drop by 10%, this is how much debt capacity shrinks. If it goes by 10%, it increases. So I'd say for the general fund, I've done some back of the envelope myself. It has a big impact. And capacity shrinks quite quickly if revenue forecasts start shrinking, which is why we try to do at least an annual review of our forecast and adjust accordingly.
I'm not sure that my question was, is it risk adjusted? Is that a yes or no?
Well, maybe not as professionally as perhaps an economist, but if we give you if revenues drop by 10%, if revenues increase, we can give you a sensitivity analysis of what that range of value would be.
Thank you, because that was the point of my question, is that we understand the volatility of our revenue system and make decisions accordingly. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah Morris. No further questions. Thank you very much for all of your work today. Kind of Groundhog Day, so really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And now I'd like to quickly call up Pete Shepard from the Department of Justice and David Hartwig. There he is, from the Department of Administrative Services. And this all sounds like the title of a horror film, Lawsuit Status Potentially Affecting the State Budget. So, very important. So I think we started 10 minutes past 3, so as much as we can, we can adjust by 10 minutes on all of these, so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm joined by Mr. Hartwig from the Department of Administrative Services. And, Mr. Chair, when would you like us to complete our presentation, and we'll tailor it accordingly?
Well, not knowing how many questions there might be, if you can stay within 15 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have in your materials a written version of this, and then necessity I'm going to go rather quickly through it. But you have heard from the previous panel, I'd entertain follow-up questions offline and would be pleased to help you subsequently. I've described some of the limits of this report. Basically, we're focusing on litigation that has the potential to be a key budget driver. Just to give you a quick historical perspective on litigation related to the lawmaking process, and particularly the budget process, it's inevitable that some of the choices you're going to make this session are going to drive some form of litigation that's inherent in the hard choices that you have to make. And I've given you a couple of examples of previous hard choices that other assemblies have made that, in fact, did lead to litigation. It's unpredictable. I can't always tell you how it's going to come out, and you can't always know which of your policy choices is going to generate litigation. There are some things that you can do to help assess the risk of litigation, however, and let me just mention three of them. If you're dealing with an issue that calls upon you to engage in some form of innovative accounting, probably there's going to be litigation after you make that policy choice. If you're engaged in lawmaking at the margins of established law, if your principal counsel, legislative counsel, tells you that a given measure they can't tell you whether it's likely to be sustained by the courts or not, probably you're going to have a litigation tail to that choice. And finally, if in the effort to find common ground amongst different parties, you consciously decide, as often does occur, and it's a perfectly legitimate choice, to substitute some ambiguous language for otherwise clear language, then likely, again, you've generated the possibility of litigation, a litigation tail to that policy choice. Some litigation can be used as a pointer to issues that you can resolve, and some of the things I'll mention here are things that you could take action on this session that could reduce your risk or the potential consequences of it. I'll mention 7 major legal issues in 7 topic areas. They're listed here on the slide. In the education area, the primary issue arises from a challenge brought under Article 8, Section 8, which is the adequate and equitable funding portion of the Oregon Constitution. The challenge was brought in a case called Pendleton School District versus State of Oregon. And this is a different kind of school funding case than you may have been familiar with yourself or read about in the past. Previous challenges to the funding, to school funding in Oregon, intended to be what I would characterize as equitable distribution challenges. That is, one district is not receiving an equitable share of the amount that is distributed by the assembly. The Pendleton School District case is different. It's an adequacy challenge. The basic issue in the Pendleton School District case is whether the assembly's burden under that constitutional provision that I just mentioned is to fund adequately the schools, or whether the assembly's burden under that part of the Constitution is either to fund them adequately or to issue a report explaining why the assembly did not fund them adequately, as that term is used in the Constitution. And what the trial court decided in this case is that it's the latter, that your burden is either to fund adequately or to issue a report explaining the reasons why you did not fund at some different level. And that's the issue that has been now appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Second major issue, the remedies cases, they arise under two parts of the Oregon Constitution. And the key case here is Clark versus Oregon Health and Science University case. This arises under a state statute which allows the state to be substituted for individually named defendants in the case. In this case, individual doctors at Oregon Health Sciences University. Science and University, in which the allegation of the complaint was that these doctors had negligently caused significant damages to a newborn infant. And the claim damages were $17 million. Under the statute that I cited, the state is entitled to substitute itself for those individual defendants, and then the state's liability is limited to $200,000. And what the Court of Appeals decided was that it's not constitutional for the state to be substituted in this particular case in a way that limits that $17 million claim to $200,000. Now, that is a significant potential budget driver because the state has obligated itself to hold harmless or to indemnify individual state employees who are on the receiving end of a judgment. So if the Clark case were to go back to the trial court and it was to be determined that the individual defendant doctors were liable for $17 million, the state's statutory obligation to indemnify state employees would kick in. And so the potential impact of the Clark case is effectively to blow the lid off of the limits that otherwise would apply in the tort claims context. Mr. Hartwig has some numbers for you about the potential fiscal impacts of Clark. Second case in the remedies area, Hughes versus Peace Health. I won't spend a lot of time on it. This is a private lawsuit. The state is not directly involved. No state agency is directly involved, although the state is participating now in the Oregon Supreme Court. Arguments about it, but again, it involves the interpretation of Article 1, Section 10, and what our court decides in that case ultimately could have implications for any legislative enactment in which this assembly tries to limit the recovery available to any plaintiff. Tobacco, next area. There are two areas in the tobacco area in which there's potential fiscal consequence to the state. The first arises under the non-participating or NPM statute. Very complicated structure here, but the gist of it is that the non-participating manufacturer statute is designed to level the economic playing field between companies that are parties to the master settlement agreement, under which Oregon receives an annual payment in settlement of our litigation against the tobacco companies, and those who are participating in the master settlement agreement. The NPM statute levels that economic playing field by requiring manufacturers to deposit into an escrow account an amount that's the rough equivalent of what they'd owe if they participated as manufacturers. Diligently enforcing that statute can protect the state against reductions in the revenue that we receive under the master settlement agreement. There's a dispute about whether Oregon and all other states have diligently enforced that statute. The dispute in terms of the April 2006 payment under the Master Settlement Agreement resulted in a $9 million reduction in the amount that the state received. This is a dispute that's going to continue on each year. Second tobacco issue arises under the fact that Oregon receives a 60% share of punitive damages in private lawsuits. One of the tobacco companies, Philip Morris, was tagged with two very large judgments brought by in private litigation. Philip Morris claims that it's entitled to a set-off or a reduction in what it owes the state under the Master Settlement Agreement for the amounts that it may have to pay once the Williams and Schwartz judgments in this private litigation are final. That issue is presently on hold in a trial court in Multnomah County. Measure 37 is a budget driver from two standpoints. One, just the cost of processing claims, both the claims processing costs themselves within the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Conservation and Land Development, and also litigation expenses at the Department of Justice. It's also a potential budget driver because, of course, these claims take the form of claims for compensation for the under the measure itself. Those costs can be avoided in a sense if the public entity waives those laws, but I would encourage you to watch the and be engaged in Measure 37 issues because, in part, because of the potential fiscal consequences downstream. A particular case to watch in that respect is the Griffiths case, which is mentioned here and involves one of the subsidiary issues on Measure 37. Lottery is the next area where there may be some potential fiscal impact from litigation. This is Wolf versus Oregon Lottery Commission. And the issue here is that the Lottery Commission, in setting the rates that retailers are entitled to receive from as their share of being lottery retailers, in that rate setting is pursuant to a statute and then rules adopted pursuant to that statute. The Court of Appeals concluded that the rules that the lottery adopted in 2004, which now govern a relatively small number of the lottery's retailers, were not based on an adequate record, that the rules did not take into account some things that the statute requires them to take into account, specifically the retailer's rate of return. And as a consequence, the Court of Appeals invalidated those rules. The opinion itself only deals with those cases, but it may have implications for other contracts and other rules that the lottery has covering a larger number of retailers. PERS. Article 1, Section 20 provides, as you can see here, it's essentially the equal protection piece of the Oregon Constitution. The PERS issue arises because same-sex couples who cannot be married under Oregon law have sought to exercise the same choice that a married couple that got divorced could exercise under PERS statutes. The choice specifically is to make a different designation of the manner in which you want to receive benefits. The Article 1, Section 20 problem is that the Constitution, as it's been interpreted by the Oregon Court of Appeals in a case called Tanner, may require the extension of these benefits to the claimants. The problem for PERS is that PERS is operating under a statute that says that they can't make a choice that may endanger the tax-exempt status of the PERS fund. And taking this action, that is, extending these benefits, could, in theory at least, endanger the tax-exempt status of the PERS fund in the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service. Last one I'll mention is the employment case. This is a tail end of a case that you're probably familiar with from past sessions. This is Young versus State of Oregon. Short version, in the 96-97 period, a certain number of state employees whom we didn't think were entitled to benefit overtime benefits were found to be entitled to overtime benefits. The tale that remains of that is that not only are we obligated to make those payments, but we've been found obligated to pay penalties for not having paid them in a timely fashion. And so that's going to be a fiscal issue that has to be dealt with. And with that, I will turn the microphone over to Mr. Hartwig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. I have some information to share with you regarding liability claims. You have a handout, I believe, that's coming to you now. And what I'd like to do is go directly to page 3. I'll try to move along here for you all. If you look at page 3, it's an overview of liability claims for three specific years, 2004 through 2006. And I'd like to take you to the left-hand column on claim outcome. The first two items, categories listed there, claims settled and claim denied. If you move over one column to claim count, the claims in those two categories represent 91% of all liability claims brought against the state. The claims management unit within our risk management program receives, resolves, and adjusts these claims. If you go under claim outcome to the third category down, suit settled, and the next three categories reflect claims, liability claims that have evolved into a stage of litigation and were resolved in one of these four manners. The claim count for those four categories represent 9% of all the liability claims brought against the state. However, if you move across the page to total cost, for those four categories in litigation, the costs represent 84% of all claims cost of liability claims brought against the state. So litigation is expensive. What I'd like to do is move to page 5. Very quickly, over 25 years, 99.9% of the claims that have occurred have been valued at less than $500,000. You would expect this because $500,000 is the maximum available under the current tort cap limits. Over that time, we've had some 30 claims that have penetrated more than $500,000. These claims have tended to be employment practice claims, child abuse claims, or bodily injury claims. I'd like to move to page 7, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, yes, sir.
To follow up on Mr. Shepherd's reference to the Clark decisions and some of the potential outcomes on that, we put together some information that is a very early preliminary actuarial analysis of what might happen if the tort limits are... if there are no longer tort limits compared to our current limits that are in place. The current limits are in the middle of the page for you. And at the bottom of the page, we show a range of potential fiscal impact for biennium 0709 if there were no longer tort limits. And we would expect to see a 73% increase in cost, which would correspond to an increase of $74.3 million for the biennium. On the last page, page 8, what might we do to mitigate this exposure? Depending on what the decision of the Supreme Court is related to Clark, initially we would want to probably establish a transition period of about 5 years to monitor what our claim experience is. We'd evaluate and consider purchasing excess coverage, liability coverage. We would want to do that, well, we would consider doing that while we got experience with claims. Premium indications for that might range from $80,000 to $8 million per year. The $80,000 would be an example of being specific to the university system where we might purchase excess general liability, auto, and employment practices coverage with a retention level of $5 million. The $8 million number would be a statewide attempt to buy coverage for those same categories, plus medical malpractice. After 5 years or so, we would look at trying to move back to being fully self-insured for this exposure as we are now, and consider buying catastrophic coverage where we might buy excess coverage for specific exposures, say medical malpractice, where we would have a higher retention level of $10 million, for example. Just one note, not all of our exposure would be covered by commercial insurance. It isn't now. Well, it isn't now because we don't buy any. But you can't buy coverage for everything you do. In that instance, the self-insurance fund would be there to cover those instances that wouldn't be covered under commercial insurance. And an example of this would be our costs related to the Young overtime claim. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Hartwig. Thank you for both of you. Please, don't leave yet. I think there are a couple questions. I have one question just before I forget, if I might. Maybe it was mentioned, but is there any anticipated date when the Clark case might be decided?
Mr. Chair, no. Unfortunately, it has been argued. It's fully submitted and briefed for the court, the Supreme Court, but we cannot predict when the court's deliberations might be complete.
Senator Byrne?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pete, I guess my question is also regarding the Clark case, and the information here is sort of based on the assumption that OHSU is going to be treated the same as any other state agency, and my recollection is a few sessions ago we made them a semi-independent agency. I don't remember the bill number 117 or something, and that they are semi-independent and really have a different legal status than the rest of state agencies. Could you respond to that, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that is an issue in the case. And that's one of the issues that was raised at oral argument. And I think a great deal of the potential fiscal impact of the Clark case depends on how the court decides the question. And we can't, all I can tell you is that's an issue that is known to the court, and it could be that the court would decide it on that ground.
And we're waiting with bated breath.
We, indeed.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you. There's another case working its way through, the Ackerman case, that challenges the legal status of the practice groups at OHSU, and that wasn't on your list. Is that something that you don't see as a potential fiscal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I actually don't recognize the name of the case. Let me make some further inquiries and see. I'm fairly confident that we scanned the waterfront for the at least the highest level potential fiscal impact cases. I did a pretty comprehensive search with the department to make sure I picked up everything, but I will check on that and report back to you.
I may have the name wrong. Okay, I do have the name right, apparently.
Once again, you're correct. Senator Demel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to the tort limit, prior to all the questions about the tort limit, weren't there certain instances where things would have been outside the tort limit previously also, like civil rights claims?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, there are still, and regardless of the outcome in Clark, there will be some kinds of claims against the state for which the state is liable, which are not subject to the tort claims limit, specifically certain kinds of claims in federal court. And that's those verdicts are in fact have been in fact higher than the tort claims limits from time to time.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that subcommittees often find out during the period of their deliberations is about one of the areas that's highlighted here in terms of your largest claims. And I'm not making any reference to any current issue that people are being contacted about, but employment practices. Because those come up in subcommittee hearings, and you'll find a relatively major settlement that has been made in a wrongful discharge or something of that nature. How much work do we do to try to prevent those things from actually occurring? Because, I mean, I hear about, you know, the Attorney General's side and trying to estimate what the cost of this would be, but some of these things that have happened in the past just... we go back to this thing when they've examined state managers and how many of them have met these criteria in terms of training, et cetera. And a very small percentage have actually met those criteria.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Hartwig probably would like to take a crack at that, too. But let me tell you, from the Department of Justice standpoint, we do two, in generalities, two things. First, we have a labor and employment section in our general counsel division, and some of what they do is to be proactive with the agencies to try and correct or to help the agencies through difficulties before they become litigated matters. So we do have a front-end involvement in some, although not necessarily all, of the disputes. And then at the back end, after a matter becomes litigated and we try the case, we try, particularly in the major matters, to do a debriefing with the Department of Administrative Services and the agency that employed the plaintiff to help them learn the lessons that we learned in that litigation. And so that's the, from the Department of, short answer, the Department of Justice's involvement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, what we're going to do is re-energize our efforts to partner with the Department of Justice and work with agencies when we have a significant event and work with the agency, have that discussion, but set a process to review back to the agency about what steps have they actually taken after we've met and gone over the components of a particular claim that we thought could be adjusted. Our safety and risk unit on our claims staff will be partnering with agencies to have that discussion. We have initiated discussions with Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources Division to work more as a team than we have in the past, and so we're attempting to be more assertive and engaged than we have to work with agencies and try to prevent these claims from happening.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be interested, as these cases and other cases develop, to know what the issues are, especially issues that might lead to some kind of mitigation of the results by changes in the policy by the legislature. And that's not a question, it's a request for information in the future.
We'd be happy to oblige. There are some ideas rattling around on the Clark case, for example, that might help potentially mitigate the effects.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, Mr. Shepard, Mr. Hartwig, if all of us, the 90 of us on this side of the dais could be as articulate and concise, we'd get out of here in May. So thank you very much. Maybe an impossible task. Really appreciate it. Now I'm going to call I have Ben Boswell from Association of Oregon Counties to talk about some federal budget risks, specifically the Rural Secure Schools federal legislation. And I'm sorry I don't have the name of the gentleman.
Mr. Chair, given your recent point, immediate point, does that mean I should be scheduling my vacation for June 1st?
Representative Barnhart, absolutely not. July 1st.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Boswell, Chair Glazio, members of the committee. I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. And indeed, there is a problem. It's a federal funding problem facing the state of Oregon. The Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, or PL 106-393, or the county payments, or the timber safety net, has expired. It's gone. And the prospects of it being reauthorized appear to be very dim. I just returned from Washington, D.C. last week, and it's not hopeful, in my opinion. That brought about $256 million a year to the state of Oregon, about $60 million of that to the Common School Fund, $108 million to county general funds, $90 million to county road programs. That money's gone, and it's disproportionately spread across the state. Some counties have depended on that source of revenue for the last 99 years, timber harvests, then the L guarantee, and now the safety net, are not in a position to withstand those types of impacts, and the public safety systems that counties deliver on behalf of the state will be impacted. With me today is Commissioner Ben Boswell of Rolla County, our past president, to talk to you about some of those impacts.
Mr. Boswell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, the highway between here and eastern Oregon is clear and dry. It's the first time I've run into more snow the farther west I came. Anyway, it's not the state highway funding that we're concerned about as much as county road funding. And looking at the transportation, the highway system as a system, we're about to discover a giant pothole, about $90 million in the county road program locally. Locally for Wallowa County, that's about 60% of our road department budget. And we're in the process of determining how we prioritize our road maintenance. We will probably downgrade the maintenance class one level for each, which would take some of the roads below zero, and we're thinking maybe we're going to have to throw some rocks back in the road for them to qualify. It's serious. What we have here is a situation where it's in the case of the ONC counties, which receive money in their general fund from this payment, an inability to raise property taxes because their constitutional limit has been so low, 6 bits in some cases or less, and the inability with Measure 5 and Measure 50 to increase that, and the constitutional prohibition against spending property taxes on roads. Just a little bit of visual impact. This is the difference between what we got in red from the county payments versus what we would have gotten in green from actual forest harvest. What we have with the loss of the public law funds and Measure 5 and Measure 50 is the makings of a perfect storm. And the intersection of these two is where the county's roads, schools, and shared services fall out. So what we're asking the legislature is that we ask that you pass a joint resolution similar to the one that was passed in the last session, urging the Congress to pass the funding. Mr. MacArthur said that it was a contract made with the rural timber dependent counties 100 years ago to share this revenue, and so in that expectation the community services have been built, and so we think that the Congress owes it to those counties to keep that promise. However, it's wise to have a contingency, and as counties are struggling across the state to deal with a shortfall from Coos County, who is looking at a 200 employee layoff and the consequent loss of county services, to Grant County, which puts part of their money in the schools. And so that transfer will end. And of course, you know that is offset by the state school fund, and so there will be an impact on the state's budget, as well as the $31 million that's shared among all the schools through the Common School Fund. So what we'd like to ask as well is a structure, a mechanism that will allow the counties to work with the legislature to make the accommodations for this. And I hope each of you has one of these. It is the chart of shared services where the counties and the state share services, and highlighting those services that are accessed by the education programs. So we just like to participate in that program because we all serve the same constituency, and it would be unfortunate if there was an unintended consequence of some state budget action which didn't account for the impact that it would have on the local service providers. And so that in essence, and I appreciate the value of brevity, and would encourage your questions if you have some. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Boswell. And from this morning, I had one of those charts that showed the shared, counties shared, but I don't believe that we have one of those charts. We didn't get those. We're going to be getting those. There's a gentleman walking up who's going to give the answer.
Mr. Chair, they've been so popular we've run out of them.
Okay.
I'll bring some over tomorrow.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious if the association has any kind of information that would help us understand where, in the 33 counties that receive the federal funding, what's going on in those counties with the Measure 5 and Measure 50 limitations in terms of what their tax rates are right now and what the potential is there without reaching a cap.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, last Monday we went around the table at a meeting of commissioners from all over the state describing the impact and the possible resolution of those impacts. And, by the time we were through, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. But the resolution by raising or changing the cap on the Measure 5 and Measure 50 limitations, we don't think is a realistic way to address that because, for instance, Curry County did a calculation that indicated that in order to replace the revenue from the forest receipts with property taxes would require that they build 35,000 new homes at $350,000 apiece.
We have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, though, if having some kind of a consolidation of that information might help inform the discussion in the building.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we have that. We have the chart showing the property tax differences from the Curry County, 58 cents a thousand, to the Sherman County, $8.71 a thousand. Of course, they're all limited by the $10 per thousand general government category, but we can show you that data, how much is raised, because it's applied, of course, to the assessed value, which varies quite a bit, too.
Senator Devlin?
I think also part of that to understand is, in terms of Measure 50, it's also the fact that your rate was set, and now that the only time you can go outside that rate is with a five-year levy. You can't actually change the actual rate in a permanent fashion. So that puts them, and when you add to that the fact that of how much land is publicly owned versus privately owned and subject to be taxed, the amount that you can generate with the $10 per thousand for local government is somewhat limited. And then with the fact that you have a double majority requirement, to me, even if you could get voter approval, about the only election you're going to get a double majority is the one that you're exempt from getting it, which is the November election 2 years from now. So it's like a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, for information, I should let you know that the Revenue Committee is aware of the issue. The Interim Revenue Committee in December, I think it was, had a presentation on the issue, and we're also going to have a presentation on Monday during our overview of the property tax system on this issue. I don't think we've heard the last of this by any stretch, but there are ways and means issues that are presented here, but also potential revenue issues.
Thank you, Representative Warner. Further questions?
If I might, Mr. Chair, just a comment that this is an issue that is going to hit all these 33 counties very hard. And it is, I think, as Commissioner Boswell has described it, it is a perfect storm. And it isn't something that's going to lend itself, I think, to an easy solution from the state's perspective, because it is essentially an issue around the ability of the public lands to contribute to the economies in the counties. And it is a federal issue. But I think that the point that the commissioner made that we need to be mindful of is that there is a significant part of this money that goes into the state school fund that also is going to go away if the measure is not reauthorized by Congress. And so we're going to be in a position in this committee to be looking at the backfilling of that money and the impact that that's going to have on the distribution of funds into the school districts in the state. I think that there are also going to be overriding issues around the what the state can do, and I think Representative Barnhart, you've alluded to some of that in the revenue arena, if there are ways that we can mitigate for the impacts of this in opening up some alternate ways that counties can take a look at their own taxation situation. But again, I think, Senator Devlin, you've done an outstanding job of highlighting that many of these counties are rural, where the valuation of the properties is far below the urban areas, and the potential for tax increases that are going to have any significant impact are very low.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a summary of the potential indirect consequences on the state, not only the state budget, but the health of the state and the state's economy? If this comes to pass, if the perfect storm occurs, what will we see with regard to the long-term prospects for the economic health of the state if we see crumbling infrastructure and a steep increase in the unmet needs for community health and public safety and so forth? Do we have that summary?
Mr. MacArthur and Mr. Bob, would you
care? Chair Glazio, Representative Nathanson, we are trying to compile the direct impacts at this point. You bring up a very good point of the indirect impacts, and you can only imagine those at this point. When laid off employees leave the community deteriorate in mental or physical health, what does that cost? What's the impact? It's really difficult to measure.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe Representative Morgan has hit one of the key issues, and it's going to be a very difficult one to deal with, and that is the fact that a large number of counties in Oregon have a very substantial portion of their natural resource production land in under federal ownership. The federal government has done an extremely poor job in a whole variety of ways in managing that land over the last 25 years or so. I think everyone in Oregon agrees with that, regardless of whether they agree on a solution. And actually finding a way to put that land back into production that meets our current standards for sustainability and the value of the environment is also not going to be easy. We have, unfortunately, very little to say about that directly, because the federal government owns the property and the federal Congress will decide how they're going to handle it. But I think that we should do everything we can as a legislature, and I don't know that it necessarily means this committee, but somewhere, to try to influence that decision. And I think it's important for us to start thinking way outside the normal boxes as we deal with this. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say a whole lot about it because I know we're past time, but simply to note that we now have an independent board, a semi-independent board in its actual operations, although not legally, in the State Board of Forestry to handle our own forest land. The federal government has proved to be unable to manage its forest lands for a variety of reasons. And it may be time for us to start talking to the federal government about changing the way the federal forest lands are managed so that we actually can deal both with environmental needs and with the need to use to put a significant portion of the state's natural resources production land back into production. Again, I acknowledge this is not easy, and it's something that we don't have direct control over, but it's something we ought to start talking about.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I think Ms. MacArthur had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Representative Barnhart's comments.
We're going to have one more question from Senator Devlin, and then we're going to adjourn.
I just want to mention that there is a proposal out there by the ONC counties that AOC, has, the Association of Oregon Counties, has endorsed, and that would call for selling approximately half of the ONC lands to create a trust fund and into other hands, and then managing as other uses, the half that was more sensitive environmentally. It's calculated that could raise enough money to fund what was lost by this program nationwide. And it's a very intriguing proposal. I hope that you might take a look at that, too.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, I just wanted to state, Mr. Chairman, that in looking at adjusting the essential budget level for the state school fund, they've already looked at and added back in the $31 million plus $31.8 in terms of money that would have gone into the state school fund in terms of adjusting the essential budget level. I'm not too clear about on the public safety side, but in our previous discussion of lawsuits, I'm not so sure that we wouldn't have potential lawsuits if some of our partners in terms of performing human services functions couldn't perform those human services functions and might seek redress in terms of getting those functions performed at the local level if we didn't have a county that was prepared to provide them or some other entity that lost funds also.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Colleagues, thank you very much. Obviously, your testimony and the issues have had a tremendous impact, and I think Senator Bates said it well this morning that this isn't a rural problem solely. It's an Oregon problem, and the set of issues are complicated and very challenging. And so thank you very much for the time and effort. And I will call this information meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.